Hey there, and welcome back to the Electric City Magazine podcast. Today on the program, we're going to be talking about how Peterborough is, or maybe how Peterborough should be, responding to the opioid crisis. I'm going to be sharing bits of a conversation I had last month with Chris Jowden, the harm reduction coordinator at PERN. PERN is the agency that is leading harm reduction efforts in Peterborough right now. Harm reduction means supporting people that use drugs and helping them to do so in ways that are safe for themselves and safe for their communities. And as Jordan explained to me, harm reduction is really important work in Peterborough right now. The opioid crisis is claiming lives across Canada, and its effects are being felt particularly strongly here in Peterborough.
First of all, this is probably the worst public health crisis in modern Canadian history. The last public health emergency that was declared was actually SARS, which ultimately took the lives of 46 people. Last year, almost 4,000 Canadians died in 2017 alone. Again, in 2018, we're already set to sort of overtake that number just in the first few months, January, February, March of 2018. There was a 50% increase from that same period the year before. Still not a public health emergency for whatever reason, but again, really speaks to, again, the enormity of this crisis. Ontario has been hit by this particularly hard. And again, even locally here in Peterborough, Peterborough has the fourth highest rate of overdose in all of Ontario, which has some of the worst overdose rates in Canada, which has some of the worst overdose rates in the world. So that really speaks to, again, the enormity of this crisis. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that, again, it's so easy to think of issues related to substance use as being something that's at arm's length, that's not necessarily touching me. But when you look into the data and the statistics, what you see emerge is a crisis that really is touching all aspects of society. There's a sort of a think tank called the Ontario Drug Policy Research Network that sort of does a lot of data analysis looking into the issue. And one of the things, they came up with a report that was looking at trends in sort of opiate use over a 20-25 year period. One of the things that they were looking at is who was impacted by this crisis. And what they found from the data was that it was everybody. It was young folks, old folks, all genders, high income, low income, prescription use, non-prescription use. So again, I think that we have this image in our heads that's been perpetuated by film and television, the media, around what sort of problematic substance use looks like, when in reality that's not actually a reflection of what we're seeing in our communities. We think of this thing as being maybe something that's not impacting me directly, but the reality is that it probably is in ways that you might not even necessarily be aware of.
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons why it sometimes feels like it's at arm's length is because the stories of drug users sometimes don't get told because drugs are criminalized in so many different ways. Those stories, they're scared of sharing those stories, right? Because they could get charged.
Yeah, so I mean, I like to frame this in terms of, I think stories are a really great way to frame this issue, recognizing that, we all have a story to tell based on our past, our history, experiences. It's how we define ourselves. It's how we navigate spaces, and it's how we form connections with one another. If I encounter somebody whose story is familiar to mine or that I have a context for, again, a connection is typically formed. But if I encounter a story that's dissimilar to my own that I don't have a context for, there tends to be a rift. But what, to your point, what we need to be aware of is that in addition to the stories that we each individually have to tell, there's also a much broader story at play. Again, that story I just alluded to, told by those in power, the privileged, the culture at large, told by film, television, media, the news. It's a story that's incredibly pervasive. It's not necessarily a story that's wholly accurate. When you think about, again, the complexities and nuances of an individual life, how can one broad narrative possibly encompass even two people's story, let alone an entire group of people? And the reality is, for a lot of folks in our community who aren't often afforded a platform with which to share their story or a voice with which to speak it, we often hear those stories told not from the lips of the person whose story it is to tell. We hear those stories told for them, again, by that broader narrative. But again, that narrative is not necessarily wholly accurate. And so it's so easy. And I think one of the sort of leading drivers to, again, the crisis that we're seeing is honestly stigma. The reality that, again, we have so many amazing services in our community, but again, there can often be an unwillingness to engage with those services because of a fear of being belittled or judged in any way, shape, or form. I've been doing this work in some degree for about 10 years now, and the amount of, again, horror stories that I've heard from folks who have attempted to navigate services, have made that courageous step of seeking out help, and have been made to feel worse as a result, is pretty alarming. And the unfortunate reality is that it often only takes, you know, one negative experience to potentially forever close a door, either figuratively or literally. And so, again, we have, again, these services, but, again, a lot of folks who are unwilling to engage with those services because of a fear of being judged. And I think we can all, you know, sort of attest to those experiences. If we've ever reached out to, you know, a place of business or a person in our lives and have been made to feel worse as a result, what's the likelihood that we're going to return to that place? So when looking at sort of this crisis as a whole, I honestly think that the central thing that we need to sort of address is the ways that we each, you know, myself included, all inadvertently contribute to these stigmatizing systems and attitudes.
The cornerstone of most harm reduction programs involves providing spaces where people can use drugs without fear of being charged or stigmatized. Safe injection sites. Jarden would like to see a safe injection site established in Peterborough because they've been proven to reduce overdose deaths and to help people treat their addictions.
Harm reduction has been controversial for reasons I'm sure you can guess over the years. As a result, it's been heavily scrutinized. And time again, what the evidence has overwhelmingly shows is this is very efficacious. This works. One of the initial, the first supervised injection site. So overdose prevention site is temporary. Supervised injection site is a federal initiative that creates a permanent facility. The first of its kind was in Vancouver. It was called Insight. It was in the Lower East Side of Vancouver, which was one of the most impoverished areas in all of the country. That postal code had the highest overdose rate in all of Canada. And so they opened this facility, I think it was back in 2001, if I'm not mistaken. Again, there was a lot of concern within the community that this was going to, you know, add to the problem. And so as a result, it was closely monitored. They took baseline sort of data of the community and measured the impact at every step of the way. And just a few years ago, they sort of collated all the data that they collected over the years to see what the overall impact had been on that community. And what they saw was around a 35% reduction in overdoses and around a 30% increase in those successfully entering treatment. The reason being, again, if we create spaces where people feel comfortable, where they feel like they can access services and not be judged and feel safe, again, relationships start to form with those individuals. Relationships are somewhere you start to have conversations that you might not otherwise have. And again, when you get to a certain level, again, maybe that person will identify that, you know what, I do want to get support in this area. And because we have that relationship, I'm able to support that person in that way. Insight doesn't just provide supervised injection. They also do full primary health care, a whole range of counseling and treatment supports. And I think that's really the model that we need to take with health and social services as a whole. The traditional approach has been very much based on, you know, medical best practice and my years of expertise and all my knowledge, you know, I'm going to use that to tell you what it is you need to focus on in your life to find a solution and to be the best possible version of yourself. But what we're really trying to sort of shift towards, again, is a harm reduction approach, which says the only expert in your life is you. The only expert in my life is me, and thus you are the person who's best, you know, positioned to identify what your goal or priority is in any given moment. It's my job as a health and social service provider to listen to you, to sort of take your lead and to come alongside you and support you in the ways that you've identified. So as much as, you know, I might want that to be, you know, safer drug use or reducing drug use or getting off drugs, if that's not your priority in any given moment, I can't make it be. And if I try and thrust that on you, all I'm actually doing is damage. Because the reality is as well-intentioned as I might be in sort of pushing towards that, again, if you're telling me that this is a thing that you need in your life and I'm not listening to you and I'm telling you, let's focus on this thing over here, what I'm doing is I'm actually breaking down that relationship. And at a certain point, that relationship's not going to exist. And then I'm not going to have the opportunity to engage in your life in any way, shape, or form because we don't have a relationship.
As Jarden's been saying, he believes building relationships with people who use drugs and creating meaningful opportunities for people with addictions is the most important work we can do right now to address the opioid crisis and other substance use issues. He says it's a whole new way of thinking about addictions treatment and that it's grounded in science.
I think the most important thing to recognize is that a lot of our understanding around substance use is actually... I think the popular sort of understanding of substance use and addiction really comes from outdated information. Almost the turn of the century, there was a series of studies that were done looking into the nature of addiction, and the way that those were sort of rolled out were that a rat was put in a cage with a bottle of water and a bottle of heroin, and the rats were observed to see, you know, what they would sort of engage in, and almost 100 times in these studies, or 100% of the time in these studies, the rat would, after trying the water laced with heroin, would drink itself into an overdose. And that really sort of informed a lot of our understanding of the nature of addiction for the better part of the last century. And it wasn't only actually in the 1970s, there was a physician, a Canadian physician actually, by the name of Dr. Bruce Alexander, who saw some sort of questionable sort of methods within those initial trials. And so what he did was create something called Rat Park, which was, again, this giant cage that had like wood chips and tunnels and cheese and other rats to interact with, put the bottle of water and the bottle of water laced with heroin in that cage, and you went from almost 100% overdose rate to 0%. So even the rats that tried the heroin would not go back to it because, again, they had these other sort of points of connection. Again, you might write that off to being a quirk of rats, but the reality is at the same time, there was a very human example, which was the Vietnam War. It's estimated that roughly 20% of U.S. troops were heavily using heroin when in Vietnam. There was a lot of sort of fear at the time that, again, these troops would come back to America and cause all these issues within the community. And so the troops were actually followed around. But the interesting thing that the researchers observed was that 95% of the troops never used ever again. And again, it really speaks to that idea that substance use is so much broader than chemical hooks, which has, again, been our popular understanding. It really touches on so many different facets of life. And at the end of the day, I think one of the central underlying features to anyone's relationship with substance use is connection or a lack of connection. Again, we as humans are built to be in community, to be in connection with one another. And if I'm lacking those supports, again, often people turn to substance use as a way to address some of those gaps in their lives. And what you see, again, in the research and the literature is that, again, when you address that connection, again, it leads to, again, much more sustainable and effective sort of health outcomes. Although some of the work that I do at PARN is really engaged in getting people in the community involved in the work in a meaningful way. So people with lived experience. And one of the examples I like to cite is a number of years ago, one of the folks who had come through the program and had been involved in PARN for a number of months, when I was doing my exit interview with him, talking about his experiences, he said, you know, unsolicited, you know, Chris, I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, when I first started here, my substance use really started to get away from me, and I was sort of going down a dark path. But after all these months of being engaged in this work, and finding that, you know, I felt like a part of a team, that I had something sort of meaningful to contribute back to my community, that I had the sense of purpose, I realized I didn't need to find those things at the end of a needle. And I was like, wow, that's really, again, a poetic way of putting that, but really speaks to, again, sort of the broader complexities of people's relationships to substance use. Again, what this individual was ultimately looking for was, again, some substantial connection and some meaning and engagement. And I think that when we ever hope to really tackle substance use, it's not going to be from, again, methadone clinics or from naloxone programs or from rehab centers. It's going to be about addressing our societal stigma that, again, prevents people from having meaningful connection and creating meaningful opportunities for people within the community. One of the initiatives that the DBIA has sort of engaged in recently is, again, creating some opportunities just like that. So one of the things that they're doing is creating a downtown community cleanup crew, providing a number of different positions to folks in the community to, again, have some way to, again, meaningfully contribute back to their community and have, again, that sense of purpose. And I think initiatives like that are really ultimately, I think, the sort of the central, one of the central answers in sort of, again, combating, again, the broader issue.
Thanks so much to Chris Jordan for sharing his insights about harm reduction with us. That's all for this installment of the Electric City Magazine podcast. If you like the music that we've been listening to, it's by Prime Junk. You should head over to their Bandcamp to support them. And if you'd like to support us, Electric City Magazine, and the citizen-led journalism that we're practicing, head over to our Patreon page and sign up to become a patron. Thanks for listening. We'll chat again soon.